I'd like to speak this evening about one of the central themes of the Buddha's teaching. And I, for myself, describe this theme as living in rental accommodation. It's more traditionally talked about in terms of impermanence. And it's a fundamental element, a central theme in the Dharma teachings, and a recognition of the truth of our life, that things change. They do not last or stay the same. And the Buddha spoke of this as being the elephant's footprint. And the elephant's footprint is the footprint which encompasses the footprint of any other creature. It's that big. And likewise, the truth of impermanence, anicca was the word he used. The truth of impermanence encompasses all truths in this worldly realm. All that arises is subject to passing. All that comes into being ceases. This is the truth of change, of impermanence, anicca, and it dominates the world of things. So this human existence is essentially, we could say, to be understood in the light of this as living in rental accommodation. When my wife Catherine and I came to live in England, where she's from, after we'd been elsewhere for some time, we didn't have much money. This was quite some years ago, and some friends of ours helped arrange a place for us to stay at the home of an elderly and wealthy gentleman who'd turned his home into a trust for, amongst other things, spiritual exploration, a Sharpam Trust, which is not far from Gaya House, the retreat centre in Devon, where we live near now. Anyway, we were invited to come and stay at this place. We didn't have to pay rent. We were given a nice apartment. And all we had to do was sort of be there in case this old gentleman needed some help. Now, he didn't really think he needed any help at all. It was mostly his daughters who thought he needed help. So we had a pretty good deal. We didn't really have to do anything. We got to live in a very nice place. It was lovely. And just as, you know, about a year and a little bit more, just the very kind person who'd said to us, look, you can come and stay here, invited us to come and have a chat, and just as kindly said, actually, we'd like you to leave. And it was like, well, what can you say? Okay. Gave us enough time to at least try and find somewhere else to go, which we didn't quite manage, so we ended up staying at another friend's house who was away for a month, and went through a period of relative homelessness in which we moved in with friends and then found a place where we could stay for a month or two, and eventually some good friends of ours who we'd known for quite a while, not that closely, but we had a good connection with them. They were in a situation, unfortunate, rather different than ours, that they could buy a home and were buying quite a large home. So they said, why don't you come and live with us? We don't want to live on our own. We've got a big house. There's just the two of us. No kids there. So we thought, great. And we paid rent, but it was a kind of reduced rent because we were sort of living and sharing responsibilities for the home and seemed to be going pretty well, you know. But living with people is living with people. You've probably had some experience of that. And after about a year and a half, they very sort of kindly, but a little bit sort of anxiously said to us, you know, we've actually decided that we'd like you to leave. And it was kind of, oh, okay, was it something we said, you know? Not taking it too personally, but there's also something quite significant in that situation of saying, oh yeah, these circumstances that we have just can be taken away from us. And this whole human existence, in fact, is simply living in rental accommodation. This body and thinking mind is a temporary circumstance for us, and the landlord is kind of unpredictable. You don't know when you're going to get that message, hey, you can't live here anymore. We don't. None of us do. So this is something that we're invited to reflect on, to consider, to look at. What does this mean for my life and how I live in this world? And the reflection that the Buddha invited us to pick up on a regular, even daily basis, is to consider all that is mine, beloved and dear to me, this I will be parted from. All that is mine, beloved or precious and dear to me, this I will be parted from. And to really turn towards the truth of that in our lives is a challenging but powerful thing, and something really important, and something one finds not just in Buddhist teaching. In many spiritual traditions, there's some recognition of this. When we contemplate this, just to notice what that's like. Because we kind of know it, but socially, our agreement is we don't really talk about that very much. We don't ever really say, you know, that's how it is, isn't it? Or if we do, we're fortunate to be in circles where that might be spoken. We will die at some time, unknown to us, and likewise others, really acknowledging, oh yeah, that's how life is. It doesn't go on forever. And that there may well be sadness or grief at that truth. And that's not inappropriate. It's not that we're supposed to somehow say, oh, well, that's cool, or I don't really care. Because the truth is we do care. But nonetheless, that's still how it is. Often we don't recognize this. We don't really allow ourselves to come close to the truth and to the implications of this truth. Unless it seems to be happening soon. And just about now, I guess 2.5 weeks ago, a friend of mine who'd been diagnosed some few months earlier with cancer was just in the last days of his life. He didn't know it quite then that they were the last days, but had the opportunity to visit with them, and they're amazing. He said, you know, can you put your hand here and just feel this? Because there's a tumour growing through the ribs of his chest at the same time as it was growing into his chest and squeezing his lungs so he couldn't breathe very well. And he wanted us to sit and just make contact. It was very touching. And he said, you know, the doctor sort of suggested maybe I need to talk to my wife about what I want to happen. And he was kind of like a little, and he's a Dharma practitioner, he's done this, he's thought about these things before. It was a bit like, does he mean like really soon? No, the doctor hadn't said it in black and white. But it was like, you know, Colin, yeah, it sounds like it. This is what's happening. This thing that's growing in your body, of your body, is going to take the life of your body. And I think 4 days later, he was dead. Even when it's soon, we sometimes don't quite take it on. So much harder when it's not in our face, to really look at what does it mean for my life that my life is just for a temporary, unknown, uncertain amount of time. What does it mean for me that that is so? For the Buddha, as a young man growing up in northern India as he was, and having, it seemed, a rather fortunate and blessed life, his own turning to look, to inquire, to seek, to explore his life and understand what was important in life arose out of his encounter with seeing death, with seeing impermanence, with seeing that this is what happens for us all. And he said, why, having confronted this, and the tradition suggested he'd never seen or heard of anything like it until he was 28, I think it's more like he didn't really get it until then. It seems more likely. But whatever, he got something that led him to ask himself, he says, why should I, who am subject to birth, aging and death, to impermanence. Why should I spend my life chasing after other things which are also subject to this, to birth, to aging, to death? Would it not make more sense that I seek to understand or discover what may not be subject to that? And that was the beginning, that was the question that led to his journey, his seeking, his remarkable understandings that have been shared and transmitted through the centuries in the form of these practices and teachings. So looking around us, you know, we see that impermanence and change is everywhere. It's not news. We could ask any young child, you know, probably of 6 or 7 years, they'll easily, if you say, do things always stay the same? They'll know. They'll tell you, no, they change. It doesn't take us long to figure that out. But do we live as if that's true? This is the question. Do we act accordingly? The weather gets hot, it gets cold. The seasons change, our bodies change. Do we live in accordance with that? It's kind of interesting to reflect on that territory. And I remember for myself being struck by how it often can be for us and how it was for me in the situation where it was in England, and I'd been living in England by then, I think probably about 10 years. So I knew what, I don't know how well you knew England, but the thing that struck me when I first went to England was the weather is changing, not just every day or two, but several times each day. And you can't even go out for a 40-minute walk without taking sort of a raincoat and something in case it gets cold and some sun cream in case it gets hot, you know. And that doesn't matter what season is. But anyway, on this particular occasion, it was in June, we'd had about 4 or 5 days of really sunny weather. And I was just about to go and teach a retreat at Gaia House, and so I was going to be away for about 8 days. And I remember being really worried and concerned about the fact that I didn't have enough clothes that were relatively tidy to wear for teaching a retreat for 8 days in really hot weather. Because it just didn't happen often enough to need that many clothes. I think, how am I going to get by with this? And I remember being a bit anxious and concerned, and eventually, I took what I had and went along to the retreat, and about 2 days later, the weather changed. It got really cold and it rained. The temperature dropped. And I went into my room and looked in my bag, and I didn't have a single piece of warm clothing in there. Not a sweater, not a jumper, not a jersey. I don't know what you call them in your version of that word here, but a warm thing. I didn't have any. And I thought, how did I do that? How did I believe? Because I had believed and even been worried by the fact that it was obviously going to be sunny and hot for the next 8 days. And yet, do we notice ourselves doing things like that? Acting as if the way things are now is how they will continue to be. Almost forever. Or certainly for the next while. When the evidence is that that's not what happens. And this fundamental misperception is something the Buddha points to, is because we don't see this, because we don't understand this, we get entangled with our experience and we suffer in ways that not only are painful and unhelpful and unnecessary, but don't make sense given that we know things change. And we can see it in so many ways, you know. When we have a good meditation experience, and we've been practicing for 4 days now, and I know it's tough what we're doing here, it's not easy. And yet probably most of you, if not all of you, have had some moments where you're calm and still and quiet. And just feel maybe a sense of ease or connection or presence. And how quickly the mind goes, oh, it's working. Oh, it's good. Oh, I like it. I see what that meant. Yeah. Okay. And we start to have this idea of, wow, okay, I'm going to sort of do some more retreats, and actually maybe I'll go to the monastery and I'll become a nun or a monk. And we have this image of sitting in the cave, sort of shaved head, venerable, sort of glowing with light. Maybe, you know, people coming and bowing at the entrance to the cave. And then suddenly we realize that, oh my gosh, we've blown it. We're lost in this massive fantasy. This whole moment of connection and presence has been projected into the future in a complete abstraction that's unreal. It's useless, hopeless. I can't do it. I'm no good. This is no good for me. It doesn't work. I can't. And we kind of, I'm going home. I've had it. I'm not even going to stay another minute. And again, that moment of being lost or feeling of failure, we've again projected that. Oh gosh, that's how it's going to be for now. And I'm out of here. Have you noticed anything like that happen in your mind? And do we see how it's that taking of the moment's experience and somehow projecting it as if it extends out in front of us forever or for some considerable distance, when actually if we look at our experience, that's not what's happening. So much of what we struggle with when things are painful, difficult, scary or unwanted is not the experience itself, but the way we project it into the future. And imagine, not just can I be with this now, but what will it be like if I have to be with it all day or all week? The interesting thing is that we're already being with it, because it's here and we're here. If it's going to annihilate us, it will have done it already. So it's not going to annihilate you. Oh, okay, so then it's just uncomfortable or painful or scary. And that's just happening right now. Or sometimes because we're starting to settle into the retreat, so I think, oh, actually, you know, I've kind of done the hard work, I can sort of start to kick back a bit, relax, enjoy myself, you know. Don't need to try too hard. And certainly not efforting or forcing ourselves, but we start to go to, oh yeah, this is nice. I think I can sort of, you know, a bit of a meditation cruise now, you know. And we forget that this retreat, these incredible, precious and blessed circumstances and all the support we have here and all the dropping away of other external demands and responsibilities, it's just for a few days, this precious time to practice here together for each of us. And there may be further opportunities, but there may not. And so again, we can see that we also kind of don't really fully honour the blessings because we sort of imagine their continuity. In the same way, that illusion of ongoingness distorts how we respond to and handle what's here. So there's a traditional reflection in the Zen tradition which is expressed as something like, these days are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? And it's like this precious opportunity to be here, to practice, to more deeply wake up, to make good use of this, to not live our life as if it is forever. There's this wonderful conversation that takes place in one of the stories in the Bhagavad Gita, the sort of the Indian spiritual classic, in which there's a conversation between Arjuna, the hero, and Krishna, who's his charioteer before battle. And Krishna, in a way representing wisdom in the conversation, Arjuna asks him, Krishna, with your vast vision of the universe, what is the most remarkable thing? What is the greatest miracle that you see? And Krishna responds, he says, the greatest miracle I see is that while every being sees others all around them dying, no one truly believes it will happen to themselves. So we know that there's this truth of impermanence, but we don't quite believe it. And the way we can see that is in line with what the French philosopher Guyot, he said once, if we know but we do not act accordingly, then we know imperfectly. So if our actions don't actually reflect the understanding, that understanding has not yet fully penetrated into us. And the process of insight in the journey of this practice, this retreat, this meditative tradition, is one in which we allow those understandings to penetrate more deeply into us so that they actually start to inform how we live, so that they become more than just a concept, which we might subscribe to by saying, yeah, I know things change, I know this body won't be forever, and yet find ourselves living as if it might be, or acting as if experience will be continuous, when in fact it clearly is not so. And so insight, we can understand it as the transformative process of correcting our misperceptions, moving from the blindness of not seeing clearly or truly to seeing in accordance with wisdom that sees things as they are, not just conceptually, but in a way that informs how we live. And so misperception arises because we don't carefully look at what's going on. Part of what we're doing here is slowing down and starting to see and examine our experience moment by moment, breath by breath, whatever it is that shows up. Because only in looking at it that carefully can we start to really get what's happening. And it's a little bit like a metaphor that once occurred to me when I was talking about this that I find really helpful. It's as if we were driving in a car on a long straight road. Now, I don't know if you have such roads here. I imagine there are some places where the road just goes in a straight line for a while. And if you look out the front of the car at the horizon, although you might be traveling along at 100, 120 kilometers an hour, which is pretty fast, what you see at the end of the horizon isn't really changing. If you notice, if you look out there, it's just whatever is there on a straight road. Now, if you should happen to look out the back window, it would be much the same. Now, probably not a good idea to do that when you're driving, but if you look out the back window for a while, it's not changing on a straight road. But if you look out the side, what do you see? If you look out the side window of a car traveling at 100, even 50 kilometers an hour, but certainly at 100, 120, things are going past so quickly you can't even see them clearly. It's a blur. Just, and maybe the poles carrying the telephone and power lines you can see, or the markers at the side of the road every 20 or 50 meters or whatever they are you can see. But actually what's there, it's a blur. We can't see it. And so this is what happens to us when we're living our life at speed, under pressure. We're focused so much on the future. We're looking at what's in front of us. And we're trying to do so by referring to the past. That's how we look at the future. The future is only a construction born of the past. And so we're looking at the past, but we can't look at the past in any real sense because it would take as long as it took for the past to happen for us to look at it and see the whole thing. And we can't because there's more life happening every moment. So what we're looking at is a little picture made of fragments and little pieces that we kept from the past. We paste there and say, that's what happened. And it's a very simplified, reduced, minimalized, and relatively static picture that we call the past. That happened, this happened. And we project that into the future. And again, it's a relatively static, simple picture, past and future, that seems like it creates a sense of fixity or non-changingness in a certain way. Even accommodating the fact that things within it change, that's the overall impression when we live in images of the past and projections of the future. And so when we pay attention to the present moment, when we're looking like that, past and future is like driving in the car, looking at the front, looking at the back. When we pay attention to the present moment, when we're being more fully here, it's like we're attending to the immediate experience and like looking out of the car at what's right beside us. It's changing, it's changing, it's changing, it's changing. One moment after the next, one breath after the next, one thought, one feeling, one sensation, one sound. It's just a flow of experience, moving through, moving through, moving through. This apparent solidity that we call body, that we call mind, that we call me, if we look at it carefully, we see it's constantly changing. Sight and sound and smell and taste and touch and feeling and thought. The content of what we're aware of is in flux, movement and change. When we use concepts to talk about it. It seems like, oh, well, that pain I had a minute ago, it's still here. That's not changing. But if we look at the experience, oh, actually, no, the sensation that we felt it in here, now it's just moved a little bit to the left. It's got a bit stronger. Or it's become a little more like an ache than a pain, or more like a pain than an ache. But we say, it's just the same pain. It goes away for 10 minutes, comes back in the next sitting, it's the same pain. No, it's not. It's a completely new, fresh one in a similar place. It wasn't sort of in your pocket for a while, and then it got back out and climbed into your knee and said, here am I. No, no. But we create that illusion of continuity through not carefully examining our experience. You know, where is the body you had when you were a teenager? I can't find the one I had. Or a child. Where is the body you had? The shape, the appearance, the quality, the capacities. Wow, it's so different. The very cellular material, most of it's gone. There's a few bits of kind of dead stuff in the bones and hopefully a few neurons that are still there that sustain for some considerable period, but most of it just keeps getting changed every few years. Some of it changes every few minutes. And where is the body that you have in 10 years' time? It's not in a cupboard waiting somewhere, like a set of clothes. Okay, I'll put that one on now. It doesn't exist. It does not exist. It's still in the earth or growing in trees or gosh knows where it is. Do we get what that means for us? And that's our body. Our mind is changing even more quickly. How many different thoughts have you had today? How many different feelings, how many different experiences have arisen in the mind? And where are they now? Where are they? Have you got them? Of all those thoughts and feelings and images, do any of them exist right here? No, they're gone. 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 And the ones that are coming, getting ready for you for the next meditation session to invade your mind and fill it with random junk? Do you think they're sitting there waiting for you? No. They don't exist. Until they happen, they aren't. And once they've happened, they're equally no longer. Do we get what that means for us? It's kind of, in one sense, it's tragic, it seems, but in another sense, there's something naturally humorous about it. There's something lightening. Enlightening, we might say. We realize, oh, things are a bit lighter than they seem. When we don't see change, things start to get a certain weight to them that's being added by our believing in permanence and our failure to see the transitoriness of so much of what we encounter. And so we find this kind of scary, we find this challenging. It's unsettling to the sense of who we are because it threatens it. And as a result, we don't really contemplate it. We don't really let ourselves see it. We try and find or create security, permanent fixity, as a way of somehow protecting ourselves or sheltering ourselves from the reality of life and its unpredictability, its fluidity, its transience, and its impermanence. So what we notice is a lot of our activity is trying to control experience, to get it to be and keep it in a certain shape or form. And we may have some idea of how things should be or what's right. And that kind of way in which we invest in circumstances, experiences, people, places, views about things, possessions, trying to kind of make something that can be solid, that we can refer to as steady, and therefore get a reflection of ourself that feels steady. Because otherwise, where do we quite land? What do we quite hold on to? The hope that these things could offer us security, if we look and see that they're changing, we realize they can't, they don't. It's not in the nature of experience to be able to give us security, to provide us with something that lasts. That's the nature of things. And if we don't see this, if we don't understand this, we're bound to be disappointed and disillusioned at times. There can be a healthy disillusioning that takes place when we see through the illusion of permanence into the reality of life's fluidity. And it's a little bit like children building sandcastles on the beach. And I don't know if you've ever engaged in such activity as a child or an adult. I guess maybe quite a few of you have. Don't know if it's traditional in Finland. But the interesting thing about sandcastles is if you try and build them below the tidal zone, below the low tide zone, what happens? You can't build a sandcastle below the tidal zone, can you? It's covered in water. If you try and build a sandcastle above the high tide zone, it's just dry sand. You can't make anything out of it, can you? So where do you build a sandcastle? You build it between the high and the low tide zone. Now the nature of the thing is, you can build it, and then at some point the tide comes in. And of course, for some children, there's, it was nice making a sandcastle, and here it goes. When the waves roll in, we can just kick it over or watch it disappear. Or it might be, no, stop the water. Stop that. It can't. It's my sandcastle. I made it. And we'd say to them, that's how it is. Sandcastles can't be forever. But ourselves, do we see that with where we build our castles in the world of things? Because the things that we build are equally in the tidal zone of life. Because we can build things, because their nature is that things can come together, it's also their nature that they come apart. That's how we could get them together in the first place. This body, this life, it comes together for some time and then no longer. Helen Keller, who was a remarkable human being and lived an incredible life despite being blind and deaf. She once observed, she said, "Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, and nor do the children of man as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger in the long run is no safer than outright exposure. Life is either a glorious adventure or it is nothing." Remarkable words. I don't think she's meaning that one shouldn't take care in situations where there may be some danger and not protect oneself. But the way in which we shrink from the uncontrollableness of life, the insecurity of life, trying to keep it in safe, secure, controlled contexts. Life is a glorious adventure, or it is nothing, or it's a doomed battle against the incoming tide, we could say. So this we're invited to contemplate, to reflect on. To see as we allow our experience to slow down, to move more slowly, we start to see, things are changing, things are moving. To let that soak more deeply into our hearts and our minds, into the cells of our bodies, in fact. So that we really start to get, this is how it is. And you know, it's not all bad news, is it? Not at all. You know, it would be rather crowded if everybody who'd ever been here was still here. If every creature, if every living thing that had ever lived was still living, we'd have some problems. Really. And you know, when we have a difficult experience, actually impermanence turns out to be rather good news, doesn't it? It's great. It's not going to last forever. We can sometimes find ourselves going, hey, come on, impermanence, you know, hurry up. Be impermanent, you unpleasant thing, you know, to some experience we're having. It doesn't quite work like that, does it? But just recognizing, oh, I only need to be with this for now. Ah, actually, I can do that because I'm already being with it. Because it's here and I'm here. As I said, there's a space that comes from bringing that contemplation, that reflection, into those places that are difficult. To know that this too shall pass, that this too shall pass. And that also frees us from the kind of the habitual contraction of grasping at things that are beautiful or lovely. Like it's this incredibly tragic thing, it seems to me, that when something lovely arises, it's so hard to enjoy it because we're trying to keep hold of it. Have you ever had that thing where you see a really beautiful scene or a really amazing... I was at the end of last year when I was teaching in America, and I saw a beaver in a pond coming really close to me, and I had my phone in my pocket with its camera, and I was torn between, can I just look at this thing and enjoy it and really think, wow, this beaver hasn't seen me and it's coming really close. I want to get a picture. And in the end, I couldn't resist. And the bit where the beaver was the closest to me, I was messing with the camera. And I didn't actually stay there and just enjoy it. I didn't get a good picture. But it was amazing how strong that wish to keep it was. You know? And actually, when we know something isn't forever or even very long, sometimes we can say, oh, let me just enjoy it. This thing that's lovely or precious or beautiful. Even just this moment of contact with the earth, when I put my foot on the grass and I feel every single blade of grass on that sensitive, tender sole of my foot. And I don't have to have another one like that. It's just, if I'm there for it, it's just enough. But if it's like, how do I get another one of those? I don't even get to enjoy this one, let alone the next. So again, impermanence is really something that helps us receive our life, understanding it. And we see that, in fact, this impermanence is part of what makes things beautiful. Real beauty inevitably has in it some element of something that doesn't last. You know, have you ever gone into a shop or a restaurant where they have those remarkable fabric flowers that look like a real one? And without really looking closely, you can't tell for sure if that's a flower or not. And yet, it's not alive. If you look at the appearance, it's the same, but it's not alive. There's nothing on it that's dying or fading or not quite right. And something about, you know, the fact that it's impermanent is part of why a flower is beautiful. Because it does fade. The petals drop. And you know, imagine like a sunset. Sometimes amazing, beautiful colours of yellows and oranges and reds and purples. And these incredible, beautiful shades can be amazing. And yet, you imagine if you start at sunset and it just stayed like that. You know, it's nice. You know, maybe I'll get a cup of tea. What's amazing about a sunset is that it keeps changing and eventually it's gone. If it was there all day, we wouldn't notice it. It'd be just, So there's something about beauty and what touches us in the fact that things are, by their nature, changing. And that brings with it the sense of preciousness, of seeing, these precious things that aren't forever. When my wife and I got married, we opened the ceremony with Catherine singing a refrain that she adapted from an Aztec poem, and prayer really. And the basic refrain is, "Only for a short time, life has loaned us to each other." And I think for some of the people at the wedding, it was a bit weird. Like, here they are making this commitment, looking forward to their happy life together. Why are they focusing on the fact that it's maybe not for very long? It's not what we normally do, is it? And yet for us, it was part of expressing, it's because that helps us remember how fortunate, how precious it is. And there's a little plaque at one of the monasteries in England where I feel very fortunate to be able to visit and spend time. A Buddhist monastery in West Sussex, which is about 3 hours from where I live. And it's got a haiku. I'm guessing it's a translation, because the author is, it's a Japanese name which I can't remember or pronounce. But the haiku goes like this. It says, "The cherry blossoms cover the hillsides for just a few days. Any longer and we would not treasure them so." And underneath it says, "Little Sam," and a single date. And I'm always struck by and touched by the fullness of what's spoken in those few words, of the preciousness of a life that was just for one day. It wasn't less precious because of that. In fact, its preciousness is perhaps all that one sees in a life that was just for one day. Its impermanence, its briefness actually shows that so clearly to us. And so, what does it mean for us to live in this world where things are not forever? What does it mean for us to really take on the truth, the reality of this impermanence, living in rental accommodation? One of the things we might notice is we don't need to somehow try and fix and get everything perfect. When we moved in with those friends into that house, before they asked us to leave, it was a really nice house. And what was really striking to me was, we moved in together, we thought, wow, this is really nice, that's really spacious, I like that view. And our friends moved in, it was their house, and they said, oh, we're going to move that wall, let's put a fireplace here, I want to open the patio out. It was really interesting, because their relationship to it was, we can do what we like with this thing, because it's ours. And we're going to live here for a long time. When we know we're not here forever, there's much more ability to accommodate and accept that things aren't perfect, that things aren't always as I wish. We don't have to fix them. We just get on with using them. It's like when we borrow something from somebody. We don't sort of do something to adapt it to our particular preferences. If we borrow someone's car but we don't like it, the colour, you know, we don't bring it home. Look, I gave you a new paint job. Are you going to thank me? You know, it's unlikely. If it's our car, we can give it a paint job if we want to. You know, our house, we can renovate it if we like. There's nothing wrong with renovating things. I've done some of that myself. But it's interesting how we relate to things when we see them in that sense of permanence and ownership. If we see this body, this mind, these thoughts, this very life as something borrowed, as not forever, then maybe we don't need to make it accord with all of our wishes and preferences. Maybe it's more easily something we can just be grateful that we have somewhere at all. We have somewhere to live, we could say. Some accommodation. Just for now. How fortunate we are that this is so. And so recognizing this, letting this in. The wisdom of change, of impermanence. There's a stanza from the Diamond Sutta, which is one of the teachings of the later northern school of Buddhism, the Mahayana, that goes like this. It says, "Thus you should look upon this fleeting world, a drop of dew, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a mirage, a phantom, and a dream. Thus you should look upon this fleeting world." Not saying everything is that evanescent, but that sense of those different images of one thing after another, just that dissolves, disappears, and drops away, we get a sense of, oh, yeah, life, moment by moment, pouring through the space of our existence, it seems, of this consciousness, this presence in which we can know our life and through which we meet our life. And so this informs our experience and how to relate to it, to the desirable and to the undesirable, the disagreeable, to let go of those things that we might hold on to let be those things we might tend to want to push away, because they're moving. And it doesn't mean we become distant from our life, because it's changing. It's not about being disengaged, quite the opposite, in fact. Precisely because it's in motion, it asks us, it calls us to come really close. And William Blake writes, I think, very beautifully of this. He says, "He who binds himself to a joy does the winged life destroy. He who kisses the joy as it flies lives on in eternity's sunrise." So we see, when we bind ourselves to something that's delightful, when we try and take hold of it, the very aliveness and lightness that gave us joy is crushed, is squeezed in that. The winged life, that sense of flight, of lightness, of movement, is destroyed by the taking hold of. And yet, when we actually can allow ourselves to make intimate contact, like to kiss, intimate contact with this flow of moving experience, something is revealed. "She who binds herself to a joy does the winged life destroy. She who kisses the joy as it flies lives on in eternity's sunrise." Eternity's sunrise. Blake is talking about the dawn of the timeless. Something that's revealed in this intimate meeting of life's unfolding, moment by moment, expression. And so, can we open to this life as it is? Can we make space for this experience as it flows and unfolds? Can we allow it to be as it is? Imperfect, as Leela was speaking of last night, and impermanent. Seeing that this is the nature of things, can we allow ourselves to simply be awake in the midst of them? To not seek to make our home in or on things which cannot bear the weight and the fullness of our life, because by their nature they are flickering and gone. The truth of impermanence asks us to let go. To let go of our tightness, our grip upon life. Sometimes we hold on, even to our struggles and that which is painful, because we're not sure who we would be if we let go. We're not sure we'd know who we were if we weren't that urge to hold on. If we weren't that battle with experience. And yet so much of the suffering that we wish so deeply in our hearts to be free from it's like rope burn, holding on to something that's being pulled through our hands with greater force than we can resist. And the life movement that's traveling, our attempt to hold it creates friction. And that friction is a suffering that actually, as we let go, we see it's not required of us, that we can actually allow things to move. And in this letting go, which is really the implication and the marker of having seen impermanence, of seeing it truly and deeply, letting go, letting go of our holding on and our resistance to experience. This is what reveals, what shows, and what invites us into what it is that we truly are concerned with in our hearts, in the very core of our being. Ajahn Chah, who I think we've mentioned, this wonderful teacher from Thailand in the 20th century, he once said, "Let go a little and you will know a little peace. Let go a lot and you will know a lot of peace. Let go completely and you will know complete peace and natural freedom." And so here we have the support, the invitation, the encouragement to see what does that mean for ourselves, without having to know where it's going or when we're going to get there, but just where we see that we're holding, can we let go? Can we trust in our lives so deeply that we just allow them to move as they do, and equally trust in this capacity to be more and more fully and deeply present with all that moves, and in that perhaps come to know, to understand for ourselves that which the Buddha spoke of. When he said, there is that which is unborn, unbecome, undying. If there were not that which was unborn, unbecome, undying, there would be no deliverance from that which is born, become, and dying. But because there is that which is unborn, unbecome, which means unmade, unconstructed, undying, this deliverance can be known. So this is the invitation of the Buddha's teaching. This is the invitation of our practice. This is the invitation that contemplating impermanence offers us. I'd like to finish with a quote from Ajahn Sucitto, the teacher I read a story from a couple of nights ago, who's one of my favourite and most loved teachers, and someone I feel very fortunate to also know as a friend and a wonderful human being. He once said, in fact it was on the same talk that I transcribed that story of the pain in the shoulder from. He said, "There is no real learning on the intellectual level. There is only a kind of learning that we do when we have the humility to recognize that really the learning part is when we go to the edge of where we know and where we control. And the nobility of our life, the nobility of our purpose, the aspiration of our life says, keep going past the area where you can't control it anymore and trust. For me, this is the heart of devotion, of faith, of surrender. Not a surrender of responsibility, but a profound recognition of what the responsibility of this being is. To live in accordance with truth, to honor truth, and to trust the truth of our life as it is. What lies beyond me and control and the sense of self is the joy of the deathless, the joy of the boundless, the mysterious vastness of life." So may we all, here in our practice and in our lives, may we all come to see deeply the truth of impermanence and to let that truth speak and inform how we live our lives, that we may move freely in a world where things flow, and that we may come to know for ourselves the peace and the freedom. Of the heart that comes to rest in the midst of life's movement.